is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, do we have a pile of stuff to get through today. And Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by. Neil McCabe is going to drop by. Lots going on. Where to start? The governor of Illinois. This is astonishing to me. I grew up in Michigan. I'm very familiar with Illinois politics. Louise and I used to spend a fair amount of time in Chicago, but it's been a lot of years, and I have not been closely following Illinois politics. I did not realize that Governor Bruce Rauner, the new Republican governor of Illinois, spent $27 million of his own money to get elected. Really? Now, to be fair, this is a guy who was making $25,000 an hour. He was making in an hour what the average worker in America makes in a year, roughly. And now he has, with just blatant lies, now he has decided that he's going to go after the unions. There is a long backstory here that goes back to the 1930s, where unions had, in the early 1930s, during the Great Depression, unions had virtually no legal powers and very little political power. They were starting to organize. You had the Flint sit-down strike. You had all, and going back through the robber baron era, the late 1880s, for the 50 years prior to the 1930s, there had been a lot of attempts to unionize. There had been some successful, some mostly unsuccessful. There had been a lot of murders of union members. There were union members who were regularly beaten. This is how, Walter Reuther made his chops by being beaten up and standing next to, I believe it was his brother, who was badly beaten for a newspaper photo that kind of went all over the country, blood all over him, back in either the late 20s or early 30s. So in 1935, we the people of the United States, got the right to unionize. If more than half of us in a workplace decided to vote in favor of having a union represent us, then that union represented us. Pretty straightforward stuff, democracy in the workplace. I keep saying we have to consider the marketplace as a power. Bruce Rauner making $25,000 an hour, spending $27 million of his own money to get himself elected governor of California, of Illinois. This is power. The Supreme Court would have you think that money is speech. It's not. It's power. And the only kind of power in our economy, in our form of government, that can stand up to the power of multimillionaires like Bruce Rauner, people who can spend $27 million of their own money just to get elected governor, just because, hey, that'd be fun. There are only two powers in the United States that can stand up to the power of billionaires and big corporations. Only two. And the conservative movement, which is basically the front group for billionaires and big corporations, I realize they bring along a few people who don't like abortion. They bring along a few people who don't like women. They bring along a few people who don't like blacks. They bring along a few people who have small penises and fetishize their guns. They bring those folks all along so that they can get themselves elected. But conservative really doesn't mean those things. What it really means is maintain the status quo, keep the rich rich, keep the poor poor. And generally, conservatives are not embarrassed to admit that. There's no shortage of conservative books that lay that out, starting in 1951 with A Conservative Mind. So here we have the governor of Illinois going after the unions. Now, here's how this works. In 1935, when unions were established, and if you are a union lawyer or a union representative and I get any of this wrong, feel free to call me and correct me, because I'm running on memory here, but I think I've got it right. I've written about this in two of my books. I'm pretty sure I've got it right. 1935, a majority of people vote for a union. Boom, they've got the union, and the federal government, through the National Labor Relations Board, the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, 1935, will protect their right to unionize. And the employer then has to negotiate with them. That is one of the two powers that can push back against organized money or big money, is a union. The other power is government. Government can push back against the power of big money and big corporations. That's it. Those are the only two places that you and I, an average person, can go and say, please help me. This billionaire or this corporation is trying to screw me. Your union or your government. And so over the last 35, 40 years, and really longer than that, because you can position the starting point of this in 1946, conservatives have reached out to seize control of or destroy, diminish the power of government and unions, because those are the only two things that can constrain the oligarchs, the rich people, the billionaires, and the corporations. And that's what Bruce Rauner, the new governor of Illinois, is doing. Now, the way it works with unions, in 1935, you joined a union, you paid dues to that union. The union could use those dues both to cover its own expenses and for lobbying and things like that. Well, the Republicans didn't like that at all. So in 1947, they passed a law called Taft-Hartley that said, if you don't want your union to be using your money for political activity, you can simply say so, and they have to refund or not take from you in the first place the amount of money that they use for their political action committees. And frankly, there's a lot of people who are union members who watch Fox News all day and disagree with the politics of their union, and they say to the union, I'm not going to give you any money for political activity. Which leaves the other half of what unions do, which is negotiate contracts. Now, in these so-called right-to-work states that came along with Taft-Hartley in 1947, now this has been interpreted by the Supreme Court and by legislators over the years that in open shops, you don't even necessarily have to join the union. These are called so-called free riders. You don't even join the union. But the union's still negotiating on your behalf, so you have to pay a small due to the union to pay for the lawyers and the negotiators. It's pretty straightforward. It's got nothing to do with politics. So what perfidious and vicious and awful lie is Bruce Rauner telling? He says, and I quote, he told this to the Chicago Sun-Times, forced union dues are a critical cog in the corrupt bargain that is crushing taxpayers. Government union bargaining and government union political activity are inexorably linked. An employee who is forced to pay unfair shared dues is being forced to fund political activity with which they disagree. This is a clear violation of First Amendment rights and something that, as governor, I'm duty bound to correct. He is lying. The governor of Illinois is lying. And he's doing it so that he can destroy unions. Why? Because unions and the power of government, when it's not seized by conservatives like Rauner, are the only two things that stand between your life being destroyed by somebody like Mitt Romney shipping it over your job overseas and keeping things here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Rauner, by the way, who was making $25,000 an hour last year, bought a business and shipped thousands of jobs overseas. Surprised? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I mean, this is insane. This is insane. There's a number of other things in the news that I want to get to and get through as well, particularly since we have no Free Speech TV callers on the board right now, which I normally go to during this break. Campbell Robertson in today's New York Times is writing an article. The headline of the article is History of Lynching in the South documents nearly 4,000 names. They want to create, they're creating a museum, and they want to put it an exhibit up of all the places where African-Americans were lynched in the South. Now, there were a few lynchings in the North, but the vast majority of them were in the South, and they were happening with startling frequency. More people died from lynching than died on 9/11. Let me say that again. More people died from lynching than died on 9/11. But we're all hysterical about 9/11, and we're all hysterical about Muslim terrorists. What about the white Christian terrorists who killed people by lynching them? Why do we not even acknowledge that? Could it be because most of our media is corporate and old, pale, and stale? I wince a little bit because I'm old, pale, and stale, but hey, I like to think that I'm a little more enlightened than most of these guys who are just serving their own self-interests. The article by Campbell Robertson starts out, a block from the tourist-swarmed headquarters of the former Texas School Book Depository. Remember that? That's where Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot Jack Kennedy. I say allegedly. Sits the old county courthouse, now a museum. In 1910, a group of men rushed into the courthouse, threw a rope around the neck of a black man accused of sexually assaulting a three-year-old white girl, threw the other end of the rope out the window. A mob outside yanked the man, Alan Brooks, to the ground and strung him up at the ceremonial arch a few blocks down Main Street. South of the city, past the Trinity River Bottoms, a black man named W.R. Taylor was hanged by a mob in 1889. Farther south still is the community of Streetman, where 25-year-old George Gay was hanged from a tree and shot hundreds of times in 1922. And just beyond that is Kirvin, where three black men, two of them almost certainly innocent, were accused of killing a white woman and under the gaze of hundreds of soda-drinking spectators were castrated, stabbed, beaten, tied to a plow, and set afire in the spring of 1944. Brian Stevenson is the guy who's working to change this. He's with the Equal Justice Initiative out of Montgomery, Alabama. They issued a report on this. They want to put together a map showing all the places where all these lynchings occur. And when you look at the map, you can see this in the New York Times today. It's pretty shocking. The various epicenters. This is the legacy of slavery. And of the white privilege that it engendered and that continues to this day. Amazing. We'll be back with a little more. I got a few other things here I want to riff about, and we'll be back right after this. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and continuing along, there's a bunch of other stuff in the news. Did you see this thing? This is over at Huffington Post. Bruce Kushnick writing about Time Warner Cable's high-speed internet profit. Now, you know, Comcast wants to buy Time Warner. They want to become the giant ISP. They're trying to fight the net neutrality so that they can really screw you and charge you lots and lots and lots of money for, oh, you want news? Oh, you want to stream Netflix, whatever. And hopefully the FCC is going to say, no, we're going to regulate, you know, cable companies under Title II, just like phone companies are. Your phone company can't listen in on your phone conversation and decide how much to charge you based on who you're talking to. Cable companies want to be able to do that with the internet. They want to be able to look at what website you're going to and say, oh, that's a news website and he didn't pay for the news package, so we're going to charge him an extra $15 a month because he wants to visit news sites. Oh, that's a movie site. He didn't pay for the extra movie package. That's an extra $20 a month, and he's watching Netflix. We're going to charge him an extra $20 a month. Oh, that's a porn site. He didn't pay the $35 a month porn premium. They want to be able to do that. Net neutrality won't let them do that. But here's where it gets amazing. Bruce Kushnick writing, in a previous article on Huffington Post, I laid out excerpts of Time Warner Cable's SEC-filed 2013 annual report, which detailed Time Warner Corporation's profit margins, that's the revenue minus expenses, for high-speed internet. This is pretty astonishing. The company reported $5.822 billion in revenue for high-speed internet, but had direct expenses of $175 million, which means that their gross profit margin was 97%. Now, that doesn't include the bookkeeping department and the sales department and all that kind of thing. That's just delivering the internet to you. But it costs them 3 cents on every dollar you pay them, according to this article. The cost to the customer on a monthly basis in 2013, according to this article, was $43.92. The cost to Time Warner, $1.32. But they're not happy with that. They want more information. I mean, more money. Excuse me. Information is part of what they sell to get that money. Which, again, is why they don't like net neutrality. They want to be able to snoop at everything you're doing so that they can compile the information, they can come up with a profile of you, and they can sell it to people who want to market things to you. Which, by the way, is already being done by Google and Facebook and Twitter and everybody else. So here over at Addicting Info, step two, that was Time Warner. Here's Comcast, who wants to marry them. They are a person, you know. Comcast does it again. Long-suffering customer receives bill addressed to Superbitch. Pardon my use of the word, but it's on the Comcast bill. When Mary Bauer checked her Comcast bill, she couldn't believe her eyes. The billing department had addressed it to Super Bitch Bauer. Why? She said, I said, wait, I need to get my glasses on. I don't believe this. Why? Because as Bauer explained, she had to call Comcast's notoriously awful customer service line hundreds of times because her cable hookup never worked properly. She said Comcast technicians came to her house 39 times over the course of several months, starting in April. This is the following February. Before they finally got the problem fixed. Yeah, they did fix it. It was fixable. It just took 200 phone calls and 39 visits. Or something in that neighborhood. But alas, writes Elizabeth Parker over at Addicting Info, alas for this long-suffering customer, her Comcast hell was not over yet. Once Bauer was finally able to relax in the evening and enjoy her beloved Hallmark channel, she found out in November that Comcast had raised her monthly bill by $50 a month. Not two, by $50 a month. When she called to ask why, they told her that her introductory rate had expired, even though she hadn't been able to use Comcast services for months on end. She told CNN Money. Now, here's where it gets even more interesting. You know, Comcast owns NBC and MSNBC, which is why you never hear a discussion about net neutrality on any of the MSNBC shows. Or if you do, it's an outlier. You know, about the only guy on MSNBC who ever goes off script like that is Ed Schultz. And he's talked about free trade over 70 times on MSNBC. Nobody else is allowed to talk about it. Nobody is allowed to talk about net neutrality. Just doesn't happen. You talk about censorship in media. So, and here's the example. Bauer told CNN Money that a friend from, and she said this on TV. I mean, CNN carried this. They apparently fact-checked it. They were satisfied that it was solid. Bauer told CNN Money that a friend from a local TV station passed her story, you know, about, you know, hundreds of calls to Comcast, 39 visits. Finally, they fix her problem, and then they raise her price by $50 a month. Bauer told CNN Money that a friend from a local TV station passed this story on to a reporter who planned to interview her, but Comcast owned the station and got the story canceled. Have you noticed you never see any Comcast stories on NBC or MSNBC? It's because they own it. You never see GE stories either. They own a piece of it, a minority share now. It used to be the majority. Meanwhile, Comcast CEO Brian Roberts, he made $31.4 million last year.
Whoa.
Nice work if you can get it. On top of this, I want to get into this this young 13-year-old man in Yemen who was just killed in a drone strike. The 4,000 lynching database. China just executed a corrupt businessman. More proof that authoritarian capitalism works. I think we'll get into that. Well, we'll see. Sherrod Brown will probably be with us at the bottom of the hour. He's got a new bill to protect American jobs. And Neil McCabe will be with us at the top of the next hour. And in the meantime, we'll pick up your calls, and I've got another stack of
them. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The proverbial stack grows. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, It bounced around. There we go. Senator Sherrod Brown is on the line with us. Brown.senate.gov is his website. The senator who so ably represents the state of Ohio, and frankly, in my opinion, all of us. Senator Brown, welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks, Tom Hartman. How are you?
I am great, and it's so nice to hear your voice and have you with us.
Thanks.
My understanding of this new piece of legislation that you and Senators Sessions, Schumer, Graham, Stabenow, and Burr have introduced is that our trade policy is so screwed up in the United States, we have no way to defend our domestic industries with tariffs like we used to have. And so now we're having to resort to using basically changing the value of our currency or complaining when other countries change the value of their currency to balance out trade. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you basically have that right. That China, much of the world operates on what's called floating currency, where the currency is determined, the movement up and down, stronger dollar, weaker dollar, determined by sales of currency and mark the marketplace. In China, they've pegged their currency at a rate that makes their exports into the United States significantly cheaper. And they makes U.S. exports to China more expensive. That means that's fundamentally the biggest reason that our trade deficit with China has gone from about $10 billion when PNTR passed a decade and a half ago to $300 some billion today. So that and George Bush, the senior, once said that $1 billion in trade deficit can translate into as much as 13,000 jobs. So we know that kind of trade deficit with China costs us a lot of jobs in our community.
Do they peg their currency to another currency, or do they simply define its value and not allow it to float?
They peg it more often than not to other currencies, but they can adjust it pretty regularly. So in some sense, it keeps them in that advantageous position. And it looks that the Japanese do. I mean, many in East Asia have done it. And they started by building their economy. They're much weaker than ours economy by being an export driven economy. And, you know, that's fine for a while. But when you have the economy the size of Japan and China, it just doesn't work for the world that way. It worked for them for at least a period of time.
Yeah. Well, it worked for us for a while too.
It worked for us for a while. Yeah. We aren't not guilty. We aren't innocent of this from several generations ago. We've practiced a very different kind of trade policy. In the William McKinley days, we were very much that way.
Sure.
100 years ago.
Yeah,
one of the great Ohio presidents, I might add.
Yeah, the old gunboat.
With Harding and Garfield and Hayes and Grant and all the pantheon of great presidents of this country.
Wow, from the state of Ohio.
Yes, or something.
Very impressive. We're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown. What exactly does your bill suggest that we should be doing or demand that we be doing?
The bill, right now, the law is the Department of Commerce can factor in a number of things when doing an investigation for an unfair trade practice. For instance, if the Chinese are dumping steel. Just a few months ago, we won a trade case with China on something called oil country tubular steel. They're the very high strength steel that's used for drilling gas and for gas and oil. We won that case because China subsidized its steel, and the Department of Commerce found that. Unfortunately, it took over a year to make that, to come to that decision while China was selling a lot of steel into the United States. So the damage was there. But the Department of Commerce under our bill must consider currency, and they can make the determination on currency much more quickly than on these other factors when the investigation is long and deep and difficult to find out how these companies are subsidized. These countries and their companies, often state-owned, sometimes not, are subsidizing their production.
Well, if the scam that China is running is manipulating their currency so that their currency is cheaper, so that their exports are cheaper, and when we want to import into their country, it costs more, and so they're not going to buy our imports, or our exports, excuse me. That seems to be something that literally would touch every single thing made in China. Are we just going after Chinese-owned companies that are exporting to the United States, or is this going to go after things like, you know, Apple and Dell and all these other companies?
That's exactly the right question. You know, it's kind of, I mean, you are an incredible student of history. I mean, more than any show probably I've been on, you've thought and talked a lot about the sort of how we got from 100 years ago to here. And one of the things that's particularly notable, I think, in the last 20 years is U.S. companies have done something that, to my knowledge, has never been done in world economic history, and that is shut down production in Toledo and Dayton and Youngstown, Ohio, move that production overseas, either subcontracted or continued the same company doing it, and then selling back into the United States. So our companies would be affected by this. That's why a number of U.S. companies that have moved a lot of their production to China to sell back into the U.S. Why a number of them don't like our currency bill, because it will in fact affect their sales into the United States. But when our tax policy and trade policy encourages shutdown of production in Dayton and Mansfield and Zanesville and move overseas to sell back to Dayton and Mansfield and Zanesville, it's a pretty bankrupt and maybe corrupt policy that doesn't serve our communities.
Well, I mean, it's brutal to the working class in America.
Yeah, and it's part of why wages have stagnated. You know, we've seen 58 or 9 months of job growth in this country, consecutive job growth. And after 10 years of no job growth during the Bush years and the year after that, but we've still not seen wages go up. And a big part of that is the downward pressure on wages from moving production overseas. I mean, we're starting to see companies come back from China, but they're partly coming back because our wage structure has not is less generous, let's say, than it was a generation ago.
Yeah, well, and China is figuring out that they've got two problems. One, they've got a growing middle class that they have to deal with, and so wages are going up there.
Right.
And in fact, they instituted a national health care program to accommodate that. And the other is that they've got a horrible pollution problem, and they're starting to clean that up. Yeah. And both of those represent costs for American companies that have decided to relocate to China.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the future of this piece of legislation? I mean, is this a shot in the dark? Is this an exclamation? Are you making a point, or do you actually expect that in particular, I'm concerned about the Republicans. They seem to shill for every big company that comes along, even if those big companies are in partnership with the communist dictators of China.
An interesting statement and pretty darn factual. This is not a shot in the dark, and this isn't to make a point. This is to actually accomplish something. We're saying our strategy is to the President of the United States and to anybody that's involved in this is this Senate will refuse to pass Fast Track Trade Authority or Trade Promotion Authority Fast Track, or we will also refuse to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership unless currency, enforceable, strong currency standards are in the bill. I don't know if that means I vote for these agreements even then, but I do know that a number of my colleagues will not vote for it, will join me in not voting for it if it's not part of it. If it is, some will vote for it, some will vote against it, but this is really a condition of support for a number of people in both parties, and we're operating under that assumption that we can hold on to them and force the White House ultimately and our trade negotiators to do this right.
But A, China is not part of TPP, although they
China
want to
be. China is not part of TPP. That's why we want to pass the bill, freestanding bill, so that our Department of Commerce can engage this way with China, number one. Number two, if it's part of Trade Promotion Authority, it will apply to the next, to the investment agreement that the administration is negotiating now with China. So they would be affected then. So we will kind of go on two or maybe three tracks here.
Have you gotten any feedback from the Obama administration?
Well, they don't like this. They compare it to the QE that the Federal Reserve has done, which is actually not comparable. I don't think there's any evidence it's comparable, so it's not going to come back on us and hurt us. But administrations have never really liked Congress telling them what they can negotiate and what they can't. The Congress always puts in what are called trade objectives in the trade negotiations in fast track, and they never mean anything. They're a wink and a nod by the negotiators to Congress's wishes, and they go do whatever they want and negotiate agreements that help corporate America and hurt workers, and those days have got to be over.
Yeah, there's this, you know, absolute wave of revulsion at the Trans-Pacific Partnership sweeping the country, both from people on the right who are hysterical about sovereignty and on the left who are concerned about the economic sovereignty, you know, the impact of this. Can this be done in a way that's completely decoupled from that?
It could be. It can be, but it's the Congress is not necessarily looking at it the right way that way. I mean, one example is something called investor state, and we've talked about that on this show, I believe, before, where it used to be that a government would bring a case against another government for an unfair trade practice. Now a private company can bring a case against a foreign government, and what's happened and what we fear is that, as I mean, the best example perhaps is a U.S. tobacco company bringing a case against a new law in a Central American country, perhaps, that, or in an Asian country now under TPP, that has passed a public good, strong public health tobacco law, that they can bring a case saying that's an unfair trade practice, or threatened that they will bring that case, and that company then fails, that country fails then to just decides against passing a public health law. That's some of the most pernicious sides of this.
Remarkable. You can read all about it over at Senator Brown's website, brown.senate.gov. Sherrod Brown. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Keep up the great work.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with your calls, my thoughts, more news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, about Bruce Rauner.
Right.
Somebody that makes $25,000 an hour
right.
in the 1%, and somebody that makes a measly $300,000 a year is also in the 1%.
Correct.
How many decimal points are we talking about? 1/100th? 1/1,000,000th? Because I feel sorry for the people that make a measly $300,000 a year and have to take the hatred of the 1%.
Yeah, we really need to stop talking about the 1% because it's not the 1% that's the problem. You know, the bottom end of the 1% are, you know, people who are mid-level and higher executives in large corporations. They're not the CEOs. They're the brain. They're the surgeons. They're the people working in hospitals and highly skilled professions. They're, you know, architects and engineers who've hit the peak of their career. You know, $300,000 is a hell of a lot of money to make in a year, but it's not outside the realm of what's, you know, reasonable and not all that unusual for somebody who has spent their entire life building a skill set, you know, a really competent lawyer, a really competent doctor. You're absolutely right. It's the 1/100th of 1%. I don't have the breakdown in front of me, Michael. I've got it floating around here someplace in these 2-foot-high stack of paper I've got behind me. But my recollection is that to be in the 1%, you have to make over $360,000 a year. To be in the top 1/10th of 1%, you have to make a little over $1 million a year. And to be in the top 1/100th of 1%, it's in the neighborhood of $10 million a year. You know, the Koch brothers and these guys, they're in the top 1,000th or more of 1%. So it's the 0.00 and the 0.01% and the 0.001% who are really screwing us. See, arguably, the top 1%, at least those who make their money not by investment but by working, you know, the surgeons, the high-end lawyers, they're the ones who are paying the most taxes. And as Rush Limbaugh likes to point out, because they have a high income and they're actually getting it by working as opposed to by investing. And, you know, I'm not saying that they shouldn't pay the most tax or they shouldn't pay the tax rate that they're paying. But what happens is that once you move from the top 1% to the top 1/10th or 1/100th of a 1%, then you can set up corporations, you can set up trusts, you can hire CPAs, you can shelter your income, you can pay yourself through dividends, you know, or carried interest. Your income tax rate goes from 39% down to 20%. You know, all these things, all these wonderful things happen once you start making over $1 million a year. And Ben, that's Bruce Rauner. That's the governor. He made you know, over $20 million the year before he became governor. And it's really and truly astonishing. But I'm with you. This is a serious issue and a serious problem that we have here, which is the result of the Reagan tax cuts. And you know, you can draw a straight line from the Reagan tax cuts to Bruce Rauner buying the election in Ohio.
Gotcha. And one last point. If 22 veterans a day are committing suicide in the United States, 22 times 365 equals 8,030 people, which is far more than we lost in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, correct?
That's right. And it's almost three times what we lost in 9/11. And, you know, which once again demonstrates how insane, stupid, and counterproductive George W. Bush's response to 9/11 was. Michael, thank you for the call. Always nice to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Exposing the con and conservative. It's the Tom Hartman program. Gene in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's up? Hey, Gene.
Caught interest when you mentioned Bruce Rauner. He is also advocating right-to-work zones within the state. Or in other words, a county could declare itself a right-to-work zone. Mm-hmm. You know, all you union guys, just get out of here. And I'm not sure that really fits in with the Taft-Hartley Act. I think the Taft-Hartley Act says you got to go statewide or nothing.
It does.
Yeah. So
he's trying to change Illinois law to defy federal law. Do I have that right?
Well, basically. But the thing is, he's not going to get that through the legislature. Just no way, because the legislature, both representatives and senators, are
Democrats.
It's all veto proof.
Yeah.
And they're all Democratic.
But that doesn't mean that he's not going to stop trying. And it doesn't mean that Koch brothers and their buddies might bring, you know, 50 billion or million bucks into the state in the next election and just rain it down on all the Republican candidates and seize control of the House and Senate. They've done this in state after state after state. Look at Wisconsin. Look at Michigan.
Yeah.
Look at Ohio and Indiana.
Well, Scott Walker just unilaterally making decisions that should be made by the legislature.
Right, and this is why the Koch brothers are going to sponsor Scott Walker as president of the United States. Trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can count on it. I know. It's a damn scary thing. Gene, thanks for the call, and thanks for the information. Doris in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Doris, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Well, thank you. You do such a great job, and it's kind of like a class I take every time I listen to you.
Thank you, George.
You're welcome. I just wanted to heads up. The gentleman ahead, I thought, might be saying this, but during the news, the 11:30 break, it was reported that the President Cullerton of the Senate is having his lawyers look into the law in regards to what Bruce Rauner wants to do with eliminating unions. So, and just like the gentleman ahead, we've got a Democratic legislature, so there's a good chance that he's going to have a fight on his hands, and hopefully for the next 4 years, and then we can vote him out.
There you go. And if nothing else, it highlights what Republicans are all about versus what Democrats are all about. What Republicans are all about is jacking up the profits of the corporations and what and screwing the average working person. And what Democrats are all about is defending the rights of working people. Thank you for the call. Speaking of Republicans, Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I just had a question. What Bruce Rauner is doing with the government union workers, I don't understand what's wrong with that, to make them, you know, have a choice not to be in the union. I don't understand why we need to protect our government employees from the government. Why does the government employees need representation?
Mike, well, first of all, your characterization of the situation is somewhat off. People don't have to be in the union. But that said, or at least I believe that that's I may be wrong. Maybe you're right. That said, what makes you think, and I'm guessing as a conservative that you're sort of anti-government to begin with, what makes
Absolutely
you think that government bosses, in other words, supervisors in government positions, the people who supervise lots of people, are any more noble and concerned about the welfare of their workers than are the bosses in a corporation? What makes you think that? Are they better people?
No, but the government, you would assume, has to abide by the laws that they created as far as, you know, fair employment. Now,
so do private employers. What's the difference?
That a private employer can try to increase profits, so to speak. Is the government, the government works on budgets. It's not like they're supposed to be, anyways, a for-profit, you know, business. My question is, these people that he's saying, you know, because they're not in the union, but they're making them pay into the union dues because they get the benefit from the union anyway, I don't understand why somebody who's not in the union should have to pay.
Because
people are in the union because they don't have a choice.
Because the law requires... Because the law requires the union to represent them in any kind of disputes. One of the ways that unions get broken in the United States, and there's a very, very concerted effort to do this, is a $2 or $3 billion a year industry, is particularly with smaller companies and smaller unions, is they will find somebody in that union who's a dedicated Fox News viewer and Rush Limbaugh listener, and that person will then sue their employer for something. You know, hey, they made me carry a box that was too heavy, or I was offended by the Playboy pinup in somebody's locker, or whatever. They'll just sue their employer. The union, by law, has to assign a lawyer to them and has to defend them and follow that lawsuit all the way to the end at its own expense. Doesn't cost the employee a penny. That's what these free rider dues are for, so that if you're going to be represented by the union, and you are, they're there. You can require, and in fact, very often they require the unions to do these things just to drain the unions dry, just to kill the unions off. But if the union is required to defend you, and if the union is negotiating your pay package, then it's just entirely reasonable that you pick up at least the cost of, or some of the cost, of those people who are doing that, the negotiators and the lawyers. On top of that, the only force in the workplace that can represent individual workers against an employer, whether that employer is some crackpot boss. One of my brothers has worked for the state of Michigan for 30 plus years, and I can tell you horror stories about some of his bosses. Right? What protects you from a crazy boss, whether it's in government or whether it's at General Motors, is a union. And you know, there's you know, this thing that government employees don't need unions, that's nonsense. There's crazy bosses in government just like there are everywhere else.
See, but Tom, the reason that Illinois is in such bad financial shape right now is because there are government unions.
No, not true, Mike. The reason Illinois is in bad financial shape right now is because we've had 34 years of Reaganomics, a whole long series of giant tax cuts. The rich are not paying their fair share. Corporations are paying a fraction of what they were paying before Reagan. Reagan came into office. For every dollar that was paid in taxes by you and me, corporations are paying a buck and a quarter. Now, for every dollar that you and I pay in taxes, corporations are paying 20 cents.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Apropos of our conversation about the multimillionaire governor of Illinois trying to destroy the unions that might represent a political threat to him. I mean, this once again, this is, as Henry Wallace said on April 9, 1944, in the New York Times, Vice President Henry Wallace, they own the marketplace. They control the marketplace. Now they're reaching out to control government, because government sets the rules of the marketplace so that they can be independent of any external authority. Nobody can regulate them. They will have all the power in the United States. No more government, no more unions to protect working people or average people, just the oligarchs. This latest is John McCain. John McCain has come out and he said, right now there's this law called the Jones Act that dates back to 1920 that says if a ship visits more than two U.S. ports, it must be a U.S. flagged ship. It must be owned by Americans, and it must be staffed by Americans. John McCain wants to make it so that it could be owned by Panamanians or South Koreans or communist Chinese, and it could be staffed by Filipinos or communist Chinese or whatever. And, I mean, there is a national security aspect to this. There is appropriate wages aspect to this. There is the being able to regulate, make sure that things are being handled properly, because a lot of the stuff that comes in is food to this. I don't get, I get it that these foreign shipping companies make big contributions to legislators. And I get it that John McCain, as do most, virtually all the Republicans and many of the Democrats, take money indirectly from foreign governments and foreign interests. I get that, particularly Chinese interests. And money funneled through all the big corporations that have moved all their work over to China. What I don't get is why John McCain hates America. I just don't get it. So let's ask a guy who I think is in bed with John McCain on this, Neil McCabe, conservative columnist, townhall.com, editor of the Washington Mercury news site, thewashingtonmercury.com. Neil, welcome back.
Tom, it's like waiting to come on. It was so mind-boggling. I kept wanting to argue with your left-wing newscaster there.
Oh, that I was the left-wing newscaster. So, Neil, why do you hate America?
Well, if I hate John McCain, does that mean I love America because John McCain hates America?
No, this would be about policies. You agree with John McCain that we should do away with the Jones Act, right?
Yeah, the Jones Act is basically feudalism, and there's no reason to have
it. It's not feudalism, it's protectionism.
Well, I mean, that's what I call feudalism. And you forgot another aspect. The ships actually have to be built in America, which means that these ships cost 3 to 4 times what they would cost if they were built in foreign shipyards.
Which means we maintain a domestic shipbuilding industry. What's wrong with that?
Why do we have one? Why do we need one?
Because someday do you remember World War II? I mean, I realize you weren't around for it. Neither was I.
I remember when people were screaming and yelling that the world was going to end because Zenith was the last company in America making TVs. And it turned out American Capital had given up on making TVs because they were making computers and cell phones and other things. Capital moves on.
No, we gave up making TVs because we did away with our tariff-based trade structure in countries that had cheap labor and no regulations, were making cheaper TVs.
Is if a group of gangsters or criminals call themselves a union, They can basically steal and manipulate and bully and do whatever they
That's
want.
That's not true. Unions are very, very heavily regulated. And what does this have to do with unions? Why, you know, the Jones Act simply says you have to have American employees.
It's the unions and the American shippers who have formed a cabal to fight this on the Jones Act. And the Jones Act, look at the practical thing that the Jones Act does. Last winter, when the state of New Jersey ran out of road salt, there was a ship with like 400 tons of road salt sitting in Maine, and the Department of Homeland Security forbade that ship from going from Maine to New Jersey to relieve the highways there because of the Jones Act. Now, that's a fact.
Because it was a foreign-owned ship. Why should we be, you know, if we need salt for our roads, why should we be giving the profits to foreign companies?
I have to get in an accident to protect the people who benefit from the Jones Act?
No.
Why, Tom?
No. Better, you are mixing apples and oranges, Neil, and you know it. The fact that Chris Christie had failed to plan for a snowstorm coming to New Jersey and had failed to organize enough salt in advance, and that there just happened to be a foreign ship off the coast of Maine, which was probably a Canadian ship, I would guess, is irrelevant to this. You talk about the unions. Longshoremen. Let me just ask you this question. I beg your pardon?
You just fold your arms and say, so what? We'll just let New Jersey suffer? Because
well, if that's the decision that Chris Christie made, yeah. If people are stupid enough to vote for Chris Christie,
sure.
And so they end up with a governor who doesn't know how to get rock salt on his roads when a storm is coming, yeah, then that's elections have consequences.
It would have taken 2 days, Tom, to relieve the situation in New Jersey.
It would have taken years to get rid of Chris Christie.
Let's
talk about the Longshoremen's Union, because you're saying that the unions are in an unholy alliance with the American shipbuilding companies and the American shipping companies. Longshoremen, and you can check this yourself over at payscale.com. They have basically the pay rates for virtually everybody in the country. They start in the first 5 years. Longshoremen start at $50,000 a year. By 10 years into their career, they're making now. This includes tips, bonuses, and overtime, because they make pretty good money on overtime.
Tom,
by the 10th year in their career, they're making $60,000 a year. Actually, it's $58,000. By the 20th year in their career, they're making $70,000 a year. And after 20 years, late in their career, by 25 or 30 years, many longshoremen are making as much as $80,000-$85,000 a year. Why do you think it's wrong that people who are working their asses off in some of the most miserable conditions out there in a very dangerous job are paid well enough that they can afford to put their kids through college, have a decent retirement, maybe take a vacation once a year? Why do you object to that?
Well, you also forgot, Tom, the $35,000 health plan that they get, where they pay zero premiums, $1 prescription drugs. And I think the University of Chicago called it the best plan in America.
And why do you object to that? Shouldn't that be available to every American?
That's fine, Tom, but let's just open that job to everybody else. I'm sure there's a lot of people who would compete for those jobs, and that might drive those wages down a little lower to make products cheaper. And let's not forget that on the West Coast, that we're in the middle of a 14-week slowdown.
Neil, you haven't answered my question. What's wrong with the hardworking person making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year after 25 years at the same really tough job? What's wrong with them having that kind of wage and having a decent health package? I don't understand why you're complaining about these people when the billionaires who own these companies, you're not saying a word about.
I don't begrudge their wage. I don't begrudge their wage, Tom.
Sure you do.
About fairly. If they didn't have the government thumb on the scale.
They have the union thumb on the scale. Unions are the only power. Governments and unions are the only powers that can stand up to the billionaires who own these shipping companies.
Carry water for the. You don't think the federal government leans on people to help the unions?
So you would rather that the country of China be profiting from shipping on U.S. shores. You would rather that Chinese workers be making the money rather than American workers. And all of this in the name of, gee, we might get goods a little cheaper. I don't think we will. I think the CEOs of these companies
get goods a little cheaper.
No, look at Walmart. The five Walmart heirs have more wealth than the bottom half of America. It's
you're
not
in the middle of a 14-week slowdown, Tom. I don't mean to speak over you, but, we are in the middle of a 14-week slowdown in Long Beach and on the West Coast by these longshoremen that has a direct effect on our economy. And it's the same thing we've talked about before. You have a small group of people who basically have the American economy by the throat.
Right. We call them oligarchs. We call them billionaires. We call them business owners.
They make they do very well, Tom. They do better than the guy who graduates from high school and has to pump gas while paying taxes to pay for some rich kid's student loan.
Okay, so I'm with the workers, you're with the oligarchs. Is that it, Neil?
I'm with the the oligarch workers, maybe.
Okay, all right. Neil McCabe, the website, The Washington Mercury, and, of course, townhall.com. Thank you, Neil.
Great to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See, I'm telling you, there is a war on organized labor, and part of it is because organized labor union members tend to vote Democratic. Part of it is just they hate workers. And John McCain is right at the front of that line. I mean, it's really, really astonishing. Okay, Robert in Delhi, Louisiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Robert, you wanted to get back to the TPP that Sherrod Brown and I were talking about.
Yes, sir. That chapter, you've explained it plenty good. What I want to know is, why do we even need this trade agreement at all?
We don't. Big corporations want it because it allows them to lock down marketplaces. It diminishes the ability of governments to defend people. It diminishes the ability of workers to organize into unions. And it extends government monopolies, patents and trademarks, in ways to other countries and in terms of time, so that these companies can maintain their welfare schemes.
Well, why is the president backing this?
Damn good question. I don't know.
Well, can we contact him direct? Does he have a phone number also?
Yes. There is a number for the White House comment line, and I've got to write it down on this piece of paper I've got hanging off the camera in front of me because I don't remember right off the top of my head. I think it's 202-456.
Well, when you do think about it, just tell the viewers whenever you think about it.
Yeah, it's 202-456-1111. 202-456-1111. That's the White House comment line. And you can call and leave your thoughts. And they actually keep track of it, and they give a list to the president every day who called in and what they said.
Okay, 202-456-1111.
Right. Now, the other number that you should call is 202-225-3121. That number is the switchboard for Congress. And that gets you all 535 members of the House and the Senate. And if you don't know who your representative is, you just tell them your zip code and they will tell you, oh, you're represented by so-and-so, and they can connect you with his or her office. And similarly, you have two senators. You're from Louisiana. I'm not sure who your senators are. I think Jeff Sessions is one of them. Am I remembering that, or is he Alabama? I mix up my states.
No.
Yeah.
He's in another state.
Yeah, he's
we
in
have,
another state.
Vitter.
Oh, yeah, David Vitter. And there's somebody else, yeah. So anyhow,
I think it's Cassidy is the one that took Mary Landrieu's place.
Ah, okay, yeah, you're right. Okay, so Cassidy and Vitter, you call 202-225-3121. Even though they're Republicans, even though they're in the pocket of big money, they still need to hear from people. And, you know, call them up and just say, I oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose Fast Track. We need to stop this.
If we got 4 million people calling about this internet thing, then we should be able to get that many calling about this, I think.
I agree. And it looks like people power did change the FCC's mind, or at least Tom Wheeler's mind on this thing. Certainly the president's mind. The president came out in favor of Title II regulation of the internet. And we should be able to do the same thing with the TPP. And I wish that the White House would take a long, serious, thoughtful look at this thing. And you know, it's like Democrats are so afraid to admit that what Bill Clinton did was a mistake. And, you know, and I understand that, you know, they particularly don't want to admit that Bill Clinton made a mistake with NAFTA and the WTO just before his wife runs for president, right? They don't want to do that. They don't want to go there. But they should. They really should. There's something, Robert, thank you for the call. There's something good and cleansing about it. Sort of like Brian Williams, you know, coming out and saying, I should have said that. I was just exaggerating. He didn't quite give us the honest apology that I think would have just turned it into one day in the news cycle. And so it's being, you know, he's doing Chinese water torture. The president needs to do the same thing with TPP. He needs to say, oops. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. The place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Well, it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, but one thing my dad always said back before he passed was the best form of government we could have would be a benevolent dictatorship.
Right.
The only hard part would be finding a truly benevolent dictator.
Right. Right. Yeah, this is, you know, occasionally one comes along, but by and large, the benevolence of toward one group is non-benevolence toward another group. But, Chris, you're actually, you said this was tongue-in-cheek, but let me tell you, we're nearly there, and the most successful capitalist economies, communist China and authoritarian Singapore, the most successful capitalist economies are highly authoritarian. They are basically run by dictators. And that works really well with capitalism. Capitalism evolved in the era of the kings of Europe. They were dictators. And I mean, we called them kings, but they were dictators. Off with his head, right? I mean, the kings had absolute power over life and death, and they owned pretty much everything. And that's the perfect environment for capitalism. And raw, unrestrained capitalism. And that's what these right-wing billionaires, the Koch brothers, all these others, that's what they're trying to take us back to. We had raw, unregulated capitalism in the United States right up until 1929. Well, really right up until 1933. Then we started regulating capitalism in a way that caused it to work for the public good as well as the very wealthy. Reagan deregulated it again. Capitalism went back to working just for the very wealthy. But then as Henry Wallace, and Chris, thank you for the call. Let me just go off on this rant. Then as Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States, pointed out on April 9, 1944 in the New York Times, that wasn't enough. The American fascists is who Henry Wallace referred to them as, which, you know, meant that generation's equivalent of today's billionaire, you know, right-wing billionaires and business owners. The American fascists, he said, are reaching out for control over government because government is the only force that can constrain the power of capital. And our government right now has been reduced to the point over the last 34 years as a direct result of Reaganomics. Our government has been reduced to the point where the representatives of we the people can no longer stand up against powerful interests, be they the Koch brothers, or be they be General Electric, or be they be the dictators of China. We can no longer stand up to them, maybe militarily, but certainly not economically, not in the workplace, not in the business realm. We can no longer, we the people, no longer have that power. We have given that power to the billionaires, or they have seized it. And so what we're finding is that capitalism is going back to its normal state, which is authoritarianism. Capitalism works best in an authoritarian environment. Capitalism works best when if people defy the law of capitalism, if they don't pay their parking tickets, if they don't pay their hospital bill or their health insurance bill, then they go to jail. Capitalism works best in an authoritarian environment. And that's what we have now, or that's the direction that we're moving. And that's the direction that people like John McCain want to move us even farther and even faster. And it's just wrong. James in Ocala, Florida. Hey, James, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up, James?
The thing before about the unions and everything, I'm a retired laborer from New York, and I reside in Florida now. I had to come down 8 years ago when George Bush was in and the whole bottom fell out because I was out of work for a year and a half. And I've been in the county here for 8 years, and I just got done organizing them. And I just want to make a statement that without a CBA, people can't get a living wage.
What's CBA?
Collective bargaining agreement.
Oh, yeah, okay. In other words, without a union.
You got it. You got it. I mean, if it wasn't for my wife and myself, she's a retired IBEW worker. We knocked on a lot of doors, and we finally did it here in the middle of Florida, which is a right-to-work state. And I think it's so important. I had to testify last week at a contract talk, and to me it's a disgrace in this country when a person works 40 hours and still has to go to a food kitchen to make ends meet.
Yeah, I agree.
It's so important.
I agree.
I just wanted to make that statement, and I want to thank you very much for fighting and all your people that you have on for fighting for CBAs and unions.
Thank you, James. And thank you for being, for getting out there and knocking on doors and doing it. I mean, you know, God bless you. That's great and important work. James, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Denise in Calumet, Michigan, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Denise, we got a minute till the break. A quick one? Denise? Denise is not there. So let me take this minute, rather than putting somebody else on the air now that it's 50 seconds, and saying, which it just wouldn't be nice to you, and just say, James was absolute, I believe it was James was his name, is absolutely right. There are only two forces in a capitalist society, in a democratic republic, in a capitalist society, or really in any society. I mean, there's only two forces in, arguably even in China, who can stand up to the power of aggregated capital, and that is unions and government. Now, in China, they've managed to neuter the unions, and the government owns most of the businesses. If they don't own all of them, they're government partnerships so that the government can say, hey, you just got the plans for that new nuclear power plant from General Electric? Let me see them. Oh, you just got the plans for that new phone from Apple? Let us see them. And suddenly Chinese companies are making things all over the place. I mean, so the power of government and the power of unions has been eviscerated, destroyed in countries like China and Singapore. And what happens? The workers are screwed. That's what conservatives
want to
do.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
That is the end result of Bruce Rauner's Illinois. This is what the Republican governor, the multimillionaire Republican governor of Illinois, wants to do. Galaciously ugly, the good. Greenpeace USA. A group was one of 100 such groups that took part in a huge rally against fracking this weekend in Oakland, California. At the protest, Greenpeace and the other groups demanded that California Governor Jerry Brown ban all fracking in the Golden State and start a push to make the state 100% reliant on renewable energy. It's still too soon to know if these protests will be successful. The people power was enough to stop fracking in New York. Let's hope it works in California, too. The bad. Chipper Jones, the former Atlanta Braves star, is under fire this week after he sent a tweet Friday calling the December 2012 Sandy Hook shooting that killed 27 people a hoax. Chipper's tweet read, "So, the FBI comes out and confirms that Sandy Hook is a hoax. Where's the outrage? What else are we being lied to about? Waco? JFK?" Chipper has since apologized, but I think it's safe to say that from now on, he should just stick to baseball, although I don't disagree with him about JFK. And the very, very ugly, who else? Ted Nugent. During a recent appearance on the Lars Larson Show, the rock star turned right-wing activist said that Sarah Palin, yes, that's Sarah Palin, was the perfect example of the Founding Fathers' vision for America. Seriously, take a listen.
Wrong. He is my hero. And let me just wax poetic, if I may. And I
sure.
know I'm dominating the Lars Larson Show, but I love you so much, and I know I'm going away in a minute. So, Sarah Palin is the perfect example of what our Founding Fathers envisioned for an experiment self-government.
Somewhere Thomas Jefferson rolling over in his grave. If Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin, is your ideal of American democracy, well, that's just very... very ugly. That's mind-boggling. Very sad news. The government has confirmed that Kayla Mueller, the young woman who was being held by ISIL or ISIS or whatever in Syria or Iraq, is dead. We don't know how she died. We don't know the details, but, you know, keep her family in your prayers and thoughts and, you know, whatever you consider appropriate for that. It's amazing. George W. Bush opened the gates of hell. And Ms. Mueller walked through them, along with millions of other people, 5 million Iraqi refugees, 2 million Afghan refugees, 1 million Syrian refugees, the entire region destabilized, all as the result of the foreign policy stupidity of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and crowd. And the Republicans want it to continue. They want us to go back to torturing people. The president says, that's not who we are. The Republicans say, yeah, of course that's who we are. We love to torture people. People shouldn't even have unions. We'll torture workers. And they want to go back, and they want to, you know, maintain an illegal prison in a gray area, in an illegal, non-legal area, Guantanamo. This is so sick and twisted. What the conservatives have done to this country, the damage, the serious damage, the damage that they've done to the middle class over the last 35 years with Reaganomics is breathtaking. Everybody gets it. $10 trillion in the last 34 years, $10 trillion in wealth has been transferred from the working class to the super rich. Over $1 trillion of it just in student loans. Right, $10 trillion goes to the super rich. And then on top of that, the super rich make another $11 trillion as the economy has grown. And does anybody in the bottom 99% see a penny of that? No, not a penny. And what's the response? Well, in Illinois now, you've got the governor, Bruce Rauner, multimillionaire, spent over $20 million of his own money to buy the election, saying, hey, it's time to bust the unions. Let's just get in there and just screw these guys. Right. How did this guy get elected? I thought Pat Quinn was doing a pretty damn good job. Anyhow, John in Chula Vista, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. During college, many years ago, I had a lot of friends who were in SDS, and I think you knew some too. And
I was in SDS.
Cesar Chavez movement, and yeah, even PLP, which I guess was really radical. And I thought they were really radical. But what I want to know is, were there dire predictions of capitalism? Is that all coming true? And why don't we have radical movements like we used to have back then? On the left,
sure,
counters maybe the Tea Party.
In answer to the first part of your question, yes, I strongly recommend that you go back and read the Port Huron Statement that Tom Hayden helped write back in 63 or 64 in Port Huron, Michigan, which then, you know, got rolled out at the University of Michigan, which is arguably where SDS started, I suppose, and then spread all across the country. The Port Huron Statement is all about how capitalism destroys the rights of working people. I mean, it was about peace and justice. At that point in time, SDS was not about ending the Vietnam War, because the Vietnam War was not all that big a deal at that point in time. It took a couple of years, and then SDS got into the anti-Vietnam War thing too. But originally, SDS was about human rights and the rights of workers, social and economic justice. That's what they were about. So yeah, we've been around forever. Number one. Number two, the reason that you don't hear about progressive groups, the modern incarnation of SDS is called Occupy, is that because 34 years of Reaganomics have created a change in the zeitgeist, in the paradigm, in the way that we all live our lives. In the 1960s and 1970s, young people could go out and protest and not worry if their protesting got them kicked out of their school. Typically, it didn't. Schools didn't, object to that. But A, they didn't worry about getting kicked out of school because there was always another school they could go to, and they were all really, really cheap, A. And B, they didn't worry about getting arrested because back then, if you had an arrest record, it didn't mean that for the rest of your life you couldn't get a decent job. And now both of those are the case. People are $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt halfway through their college careers, and they're scared to death to go out and protest. They're scared to death to lose that lifeline. Maybe they have a scholarship or a partial scholarship or some subsidized funding or whatever. They're afraid to put that at risk, number one. And number two, we have created these super databases that keep track of everybody and everything they've ever done. So if you get in trouble, and this is something that our government right now is using against Occupy, that I mean, the worst stuff that they did against us in SDS back in the day was they would get informers to plant drugs on us or in our homes or whatever, and then, you know, arrest people on drug busts. That was the big way they dealt with SDS back in the 60s and 70s. Now what they're doing, now, instead of that, they are prosecuting people. If you get arrested in a demonstration, they are adding felony charges to your arrest, resisting arrest, unlawful assembly. I don't know where the line is between misdemeanors and felonies with regard to specific charges, because they vary from state to state. But they will figure out a way to slap a felony on there so that you have now been arrested for a felony. Whether you're convicted or not almost doesn't matter, because now companies all over the United States, when you apply for a job, there's a little box that says, have you ever been arrested for a felony? Not have you been convicted. Have you ever been arrested for a felony? There's a whole movement right now called Block the Box or End the Box, which is to make it illegal at the federal level for employers to ask if you've ever been arrested for a felony, because it's a filter that destroys people's lives. And you've got all these young people who were very idealistic and very enthusiastic, and they showed up for the Occupy movement, and they were standing there in the streets when the bulldozers and the pepper spray and the police paddy wagons came, and hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them, have literally seen their entire future destroyed because they have been prosecuted for felonies or they have been charged with felonies, and now they don't have access to student aid, they don't have access to government loans, they don't have access to any kind of government job, which is 20% of the economy, and most private employers won't hire them. So in my opinion, John, and then on top of that, you've got the media in the United States has gone from being locally owned. Back in the 60s and 70s, when I was working in radio and TV, I only worked in TV for a few months. I was a floor director at WJIM Channel 6, but it was locally owned. WJIM was named after Jim, who was the son of the guy who owned the TV station. They also owned a radio station with the same call letters. WITL was locally owned. WVIC was locally owned. WFMK was locally owned. I knew the guys who owned these stations that I worked for. Now it's all, you know, a couple of giant corporations run by right-wing billionaires, Clear Channel run by, you know, Mitt Romney and buddies, or, you know, Bain Capital and buddies, and Cumulus and others. I mean, basically, you've got a small handful of very far-right people who own most of the media in the United States. So, A, it ain't happening because people are scared. B, when it does happen, it doesn't get reported because the media has no interest in this. It doesn't support the power structure. This is how far we have gone down the road toward, John, what I was talking about earlier, authoritarian capitalism. And this is the use, and thank you for the call, this is the use of the power of the state to destroy the lives of working people and protesters and to enhance the power of corporations and billionaires. This is exactly what Henry Wallace predicted on April 9, 1944. When he said I'll read you the quote when we come back from the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But this is something that we should be shocked about, we should be alarmed about, we should be freaked out about, that those who own the marketplace are now starting to own the government. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill in Dayton, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hello.
Hey.
Good to hear from you, my man.
Thank
I'm
you.
Glad you had my senator on there, Sherrod Brown. I've been hanging in there with him a lot.
He's a good guy.
And
he's one of the really genuinely honest, good, I mean, just right down to the bottom of his feet. He's in his soul. He's a good man, Sherrod Brown.
Yes, he is. It's for real. I enjoyed writing and working with him. I also last night went on the internet and sent two messages to my president. One about, let's keep our toys at home and listen to Germany and talk with Putin. You know, that's simple. My thing was about the gentleman earlier talking about unions don't need to be in federal positions. As you know, and anybody else out here listening, a United States postal worker is a union. A United States postal window clerk has to have their separate union. And a mail handler who handles, sorts, and separates the mail and boxes also have a separate union. When Nixon could not stand the strike that they were not allowed to have, he threw us at Congress and gave away the presidential power to allow the unions to come in. And we deal with people like McCain, who's in charge of the Postal Service with the postmaster. The postmaster makes $400,000 a year, and he forces orders, regional postmasters and local managers and station managers, to come down hard on workers.
Right.
So much, I had to retire from the stress. Other guys have died on the job. Other guys end up doing two and three jobs. We file grievances. The union's there, but they can't save us. They try. I was fired. I got my job back. I went out on disability from a stroke on the job, and I'm in my 50s.
Wow.
That's uncalled for.
Sorry to hear.
So I'm on disability, but I can't get the post office to follow through. I tried to get lawyers. No one in the unions wants to touch the case against the post office. And I've gone to private lawyers, and they all say the same thing. They don't want to deal with me as a letter carrier against the United States Postal Service for the damages that they've done to me.
Right. What you're laying out, Bill, is one of the problems that we have right now is that unions are dying the death of 1,000 paper cuts, or being pecked to death by baby ducks, or whatever metaphor you want to use. There's all these rules that have been promulgated by Republicans over the years that make it harder and harder for unions to defend people, make it harder and harder for unions to stand up for their workers in the workplace, and make it harder and harder for unions to be in any way politically active in a way that might inure benefit to working people. And I mean, just the idea, you know, the Taft-Hartley thing, that the unions can't use employee funds to lobby politically unless the employees consent. I mean, even that is just, it's beyond the pale in my opinion. Bill, I'm sorry to hear your story. I hope it ultimately turns out well. I wish you the very best. Thank you for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Bob Ney is up next. Stick around. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can get these Swarovski crystal hearts made by women who saw family members murdered in front of them during the Civil War in South Sudan. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity, and free-don.org as well, about Don Siegelman. Bob Ney, congressman, the author of Sideswiped, one of the most brilliant books of the year, of any year. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. How are you, congressman?
I'm okay. We have the sad news, of course, that Kayla Mueller, an American woman held captive by ISIS, has been killed. Now, according to ISIS, she was killed in a Jordanian airstrike, which is their way, most likely, to try to say, oh, look, the Jordanians killed her. But that's not really as we're beginning to find out accurate information. It may have been where they have killed her. You know, they're not a group to be trusted, but more will unravel on that. But on the heels of that, Tom, comes the big food fight that's absolutely going to probably send the wrong message when we want to, you know, fight on terrorism. That's the one on Capitol Hill, because the president has asked for authorization for use of military force. He's been operating under an older authorization of the Iraq War, and the White House has always been uncomfortable with that, but now the president is asking, you know, for an authorization. Now, on the Democratic side, Nancy Pelosi has told the press that she and other, you know, Democrats have been discussing what outlines they want on it, and you look at the statement that John Boehner, the Speaker of the House Republican, has made. Is he said, well, you know, the president's going to have to sell this to the American people. Well, the document actually comes to Congress. So when you hear the Speaker of the House, Tom, say that, well, the president's going to have to sell it, then you can bet this is going to be a huge political food fight when it comes to trying to give the president authority to do, you know, what he may have to do.
Right. So it's the beginning of the PR wars, basically.
It's the beginning, and you're going to have the McCains of the world, et cetera, in there saying that, you know, the president's weak and he needs to do this. So Congress is going to have to make a decision. Does it want to write into detail what the president will or won't do, or will it, in fact, you know, free the hands of the president to undertake this and not lay out the game plan to, obviously, to ISIS? But it will be a huge fight. And when you have the speaker saying, well, the president has to sell the measure, well, the measure comes to Congress. Mm-hmm. And people in Congress are elected, and so you can just kind of see the writing on the wall of what's going to happen with that. The Iran situation is very interesting because the president, Tom, came out and said with Chancellor Merkel of Germany that when he did the press conference that Iran will have to make a decision if they want to hold to the March deadline because it has been moved previous, and if they want to hold to the details then of the June deadline if they make the bigger agreement in March. And the reason I mention this is because on the heels of Netanyahu, this in fact is a good move by President Obama, who's been trying to negotiate some type of first time ever in 30 years ability to actually contain Iran's nuclear movement. And Netanyahu would have obviously criticized the administration in one fashion or form that they, in fact, have moved this date in the past. Well, now the president's made it very clear that the date's going to be held to, there's going to be a deal or not. And this is, of course, on the heels of the raging controversy that's not stopping about the visit of Netanyahu and the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who, and the Republicans who have went out of their way to break protocol and not have involved the White House in it.
Right. Do we know yet? The Israelis or some voices in Israel were basically saying that John Boehner snookered Netanyahu into thinking that the president already knew and was fine with it. Others are saying no. It was Ron Dermer. He's the Israeli ambassador. He's an American. He's a protege of Frank Luntz. This was a purely partisan move to make the president look bad, and Netanyahu knew it all along. Do we know what the truth is?
Well, it seems that Netanyahu must have known because Dermer is a political activist. He worked for Frank Luntz. He helped write the contract with America and has been well known. You know, it's no secret in D.C. that he has attempted to cater towards the Republican side of the field.
Right.
And how he, as an ambassador, could negotiate all of this on his own, one would think he would be removed by Netanyahu if he, in fact, would not have, you know, included the prime minister.
Oh, that's a good point. So if Netanyahu really was blindsided by this, he would have fired Dermer by now.
He would have fired him in 10 seconds. And there's also some money connotations here in the long run. Will the Republicans use this to try to say we're more supportive of Israel than the Democratic side and try to raise money off of it?
Of course they will.
Yes. And
they're already doing that.
A horrific stink in the whole situation of a politicization of a very serious issue.
Right.
I think, you know, we predicted from day one that will happen.
Yeah.
The one other thing I wanted to mention, too, this whole story of Roy Moore and this standoff, which would be the second standoff, really, in his time when he had the Ten Commandments. This is the judge in Alabama who just said, well, the Supreme Court doesn't matter, and told the probate judges as they issue these marriage certificates for same-sex marriage that they don't have to do it, and they shouldn't do it, and they won't do it.
Right. Here you have a state Supreme Court Chief Justice telling the people in his state that they should ignore the United States Supreme Court.
Yes.
This seems to me like either a crackpot or a constitutional crisis. Which is it?
Well, I don't think it's the crack. Well, he tends to be a crackpot. Obviously, he had to be removed before then ran again. But if you go back to the, you know, was that 1963 George Wallace, who said, I don't care what the rulings are. And, of course, we had to react with sending in the National Guard. But in this case, they may not be sending in troops, but the Justice Department, I would assume, is going to have to make some type of force on this. I mean, he's totally ignoring the rule of law.
Yeah. Maybe one of the county clerks in Alabama who is in favor of gay marriage could just start offering those marriage licenses by mail to people who are in the places where they're...
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. Bob Ney, author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, this is amazing. You know, I want to get back to this main theme. This is, in my opinion, one of the most important issues in America, and it's one you will not hear discussed in any media outside of arguably this program or the stations that carry this show and other programs like it and the Free Speech TV Network. You just will not hear this. And that is the power, how corporate power has become so great in the United States that they have not only reached out for control of the media, which they now own, but they are now reaching out for and increasingly seizing control of government. The consequence being that government, which is supposed to protect us from vested interests, from special interests. Read Federalist Number 10. That's the whole point of government, to protect average Americans from powerful interests. That government has been reduced in its protective capacity, in that power, and that these corporations have become ascendant. You know, a couple of cases in point. In fact, actually, let me just start out. You know, I've been talking for some time now about authoritarian capitalism. What the communist dictators of China have, what the dictator of Singapore has, I think his name is Mr. Yi. Authoritarian capitalism is where, you know, Mussolini called it fascism. But I kind of like authoritarian capitalism because I think it, you know, the average American can understand that and the average American doesn't understand fascism. What it is where the corporate interests, the wealthy interests, the founders called them personality interests, although that meant somebody who owns a lot of slaves. But basically, the people who have a lot of assets, the people who have a lot of power, don't just live and work in the economic sphere. They also reach out and seize control of government, and the way that they do this is through the media. And they do it for their own enrichment, and they do it to maintain their power, and they do it to keep you and every other American, particularly working Americans who might want to join a union, to keep you from having the ability to say no to them. They create monopolies. You've got this article that I shared with you an hour and a half ago about, you know, Time Warner. It costs them less than $2 to deliver cable to you, but they charge you $40-$50 for it. $30-$40, whatever it is. 97% gross profit margin. Really? They create monopolies. Other countries say you can't do that. There are anti-monopoly laws, which we have in the United States. We just don't enforce them. Anti-monopoly laws in Europe, for example, that say that if you have a cell tower or if you have cable or fiber going into people's houses, you can offer telecommunications service and you can offer internet service over those pipes and waves, but you also have to rent that space to anybody else who wants to compete with you, basically. And so in France, you can choose from 100 different internet companies, and they all, you know, have very high speed activity, and they charge $20-$30 a month. Here in the United States, we pay a fortune and we get crappy service and we end up being called, you know, obscene names on our cable bills. Now, China, in their authoritarian capitalism mode, is saying, hey, wait a minute. It's fine with us if the capitalists get rich. It's fine with us if the capitalists, you know, do what capitalists do. But when the capitalists start behaving in a way that's destructive to society, we're going to do something about that. So here's this story from the BBC News. This was published this morning. I read this last night about 3 o'clock in the morning. Emailed it off to Danielle, said, would you please print this tomorrow morning for me when I come in? Here it is. The headline, China executes mining tycoon Liu Huan. Now, who is Liu Huan? Liu Huan was the president and basically owner, it's a private conglomerate, of the Honglong Group. It's based in Sichuan province. They're in the mining business. They're in the telecommunications business. They're in the chemical business. So it's a little bit of Anaconda Copper, it's a little bit of Dow Chemical, and it's a little bit of Fox so-called news. He was very rich. He was very powerful. And Xinhua, which is the official Chinese news agency, it's China's New York Times, although it's owned by the government, said that Mr. Liu Huan had, quote, harbored and indulged by government officials, had illegally monopolized the gaming business in Guanghan City in Sichuan province. Oh, he was also in Shelley Adelson's casino business, apparently. He tyrannized local people, and he seriously harmed the local economic and social order. Okay. So Mitt Romney's Bain Capital buys a company in Ohio that's got, I think, a little less than 100 employees who are making good money, $30, $40, $50 an hour. They've been there for 50 years or thereabouts, manufacturing things. And back in 2014, Bain Capital dictated that this company should be torn down brick by brick. They actually had the employees build a scaffold out in front of the building. Nobody knew why. Hey, something's happening. And then the Bain management comes in from out of town and they get up on the scaffold and they say, yeah, you guys are all screwed. You're going to lose your jobs. And we're going to bring a bunch of Chinese over here. You're going to have to train them because we are shipping this factory to China. We had several of the workers in that company on this program. All those jobs are now gone. Most of those people now are on unemployment if the Republicans haven't cut off their unemployment payments. Another town in Ohio is decimated. Thanks to Mitt Romney, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, and the crew. Okay, so would you say that what Romney had done was tyrannize local people and seriously harm the local economic and social order? I would. So what did the Chinese do about this guy? They hanged him. Now, I'm not suggesting that Mitt Romney should be hanged. I'm an opponent of the death penalty. But in China, at least, they're you know, people lie and manipulate. Meanwhile, over at Fox News, this from the blog over at MediaMatters.org, and I quote, Fox hosted Republican lobbyist Van D. Hip Jr., who attacked the Obama administration for denying a request to market drones to the Kingdom of Jordan. Neither Fox nor Hip, the guy, disclosed that his company, American Defense International, has recently lobbied Congress on behalf of the defense contractor that makes the drone. In fact, they took $1.2 million. This guy, his company is taking over $1 million to promote drone sales to Jordan. And so Fox News puts him on TV and says, what do you think about the president not letting Jordan buy drones? And he goes, oh, it's terrible. He's a president. He's a crummy president. Nobody ever says, oh, by the way, this guy who's saying this, he's a lobbyist for the drone manufacturers. Is he disrupting the social order? Is he doing good things for his community? How about the Illinois governor, Bruce Rauner? He wants the state employees to basically get screwed. No more union, no more collective bargaining. Let's destroy the public sector unions. Hey, China comes to America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the authoritarian capitalist states of America. Welcome back. Robert in Greenville, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
The way things are going in this country, I feel that the only difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, the Democrats are a little more compassionate and a little less greedy.
Oh, it goes a lot farther than that, Robert. When Nancy Pelosi was the leader of the House, the Democrats passed a piece of legislation saying we are going to do away with the tax breaks for companies like Mitt Romney's Bain Capital to ship factories overseas, and we're going to replace them with tax penalties for companies that do that and tax breaks for companies that take their overseas factories and bring them back to the United States. Guess who filibustered that bill? It passed the House of Representatives. Guess who filibustered it in the Senate? Republicans. This goes way beyond just being a little bit more compassionate. The Republican Party is the party of the rich and powerful. The Democratic Party, by and large, there are a few, corrupt Democrats, shall we say. But the Democratic Party, by and large, is the party of working people.
Well, I feel that it's, at this point in time, it's really the Koch brothers, I feel, are going to buy this next election.
Yep.
I really do.
I think they already have. I think that's why you're seeing Scott Walker shoot to the top of the charts. He's their boy.
And the quality of people that the Republicans are putting up, they're mental paraplegics, and they're getting away with it.
Yep. Because they've got the money and the power.
North Carolina here, the Republicans are just losing their minds. My wife and I, the last election, which we voted for Obama the last two elections, and we had our Obama sign out in our yard. And I'll be honest with you, the friends that we socialized with that were backing Romney, they're so bitter with us, we don't have anything to do with them anymore. Wow. It's Obama has. He's done a lot of good things. I feel like he's a decent guy. But the racism since Obama became president has just reared its ugly head again in this country, and we're a divided country.
Yeah. Well, we've always been a divided country, Robert. It's just
white male. I feel like the most of the country would be hailing for what he's brought us through up to this point and wanting the Republicans to help us. But he's black, and they're using the racism button, and it's despicable. And I just don't—I think we're too far gone. I really, honestly, it's depressing, but I really hate to say it. I don't see any answers.
Do you think, Robert, when Germany was killing Jews, that they were too far gone?
Well, look how far it had to go before.
They came back. My point is they came back. I mean, it was imposed upon them, but they came back.
What are we going to get to? I mean,
I think we're going to go through a cycle very much like the 1920s or very much like the 1880s, where the plutocrats rise up, take control, run the political system, run the country into the ground, create a Great Depression. The people wake up and say, enough of this already, to hell with that. And we do this every 80. I wrote a book about this. It's called The Crash of 2016. And we are, I believe, we are going to see a very positive and very progressive renaissance in the United States in my lifetime, and frankly, within the next decade and probably less. But who knows? I could be wrong. Thank you. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And oh boy, do we have a crazy alert for you.
And now for something completely
crazy. You're so crazy.
You're crazy.
This is crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy.
Oh, now you're just being crazy.
Right. Okay. After a pig ate all his marijuana, a furious Ohio man went on a drinking binge. This is over at the Smoking Gun. This is amazing. This poor guy. His name is Chad Spoon, S-P-O-H-N, and according to his wife, he's got a pet pig, not a miniature pig, a real big pig, named Millie, and she ate all his pot, and she got pretty stoned, and he was pretty upset, and so he got a bottle of Everclear, that's 198 proof, it's like 99% pure ethyl alcohol. What's this guy doing with Everclear anyway? I mean, people use that to either spike drinks or to make tinctures. Well, maybe he was making pot tincture. I don't know. But anyhow, he drinks a bottle, according to this article, of Everclear. Now, 190 proof alcohol. I would think if you drank a whole bottle of Everclear, you'd be dead, dead, dead. But anyhow, he was so drunk that, it caused some problems, let's say. And so he says, well, the wife said just because I didn't put my stuff up and the pig ate it, that it was my fault. And I go before the pig. I guess I'll be putting some stuff on higher shelves. And then he got arrested. Mm-hmm. Maybe if I only had a brain. Yep. If you're going to keep pot and if you've got a pig running around loose in the house, keep the pot on a higher shelf. I mean, it's really simple. Or put it in a container where the pig can't get into it. No, it's not a pot-bellied pig, Shane. Oh, if he ate the pot, he's okay. All right. You win. Kurt, Los Angeles. Hey, Kurt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I know you got a in your name, but I think you may also might be a psychic too, because so many times today as you were speaking, things are coming to mind, and then like after the next commercial break, you would just touch right on that subject.
Hmm.
And I've been sitting here for the hour that I've been on hold trying to capsulize, you know, how would I formulate, you know, exactly what's going on. And what I see here is a skewed logic and a reverse psychology that's been perpetrated on the American people. And it was epitomized with your discussion with that guy from the Washington Mercury?
Yeah.
Is that the – yeah, well, I think the guy might have been – yeah, well, I think he might have ingested mercury as a kid because his logic was totally skewed. And let me try to explain why.
Okay.
A union, as you have so eloquently explained, is there to protect the individual American worker.
Right.
A union is a group of individuals who collectively can hold their ground and lobby for decent hours, decent wages, protection, because – in life, an individual, all we have is our physical ability to trade our hours for dollars.
Right.
Unless you have a silver spoon in your mouth and someone leaves you money like the Koch brothers' daddy did, that's all you have to get ahead in life.
You're right. One important point, if I can just toss it in here, Kirk, because when you go through these talking points, this is the most important thing. A union is a democracy. Union members elect their leaders. Union members write their own rules and vote for them. And if more than 51% of the union members don't like something, or if they don't even want to be a union, it ceases to exist or it changes the way that they want it. So this is democracy in the workplace. And workplaces are inherently anti-democratic. They are kingdoms. So this is the only semblance of democracy that you have during, you know, basically two-thirds of your waking life when you're at work. Back to you, Kurt.
Exactly. And so now here comes along people like the Koch brothers and some of these and most of the Republican Party. They're trying to convince us that something is wrong with the unions are bad. But if a private company and so if paying $40 a month to belong to a union is bad. But if a private company such as Time Warner Cable wants to gouge you $40 a month for something that only cost them $2 to bring you, such as the internet, that's okay.
Right.
And if Time Warner Cable happens to be a member of ALEC, which is a front lobbying group for the Koch brothers and a legal arm of the Koch brothers, because they get protection from all the bills that they write, you know, for lower taxes and stand your ground laws, so that if, you know, someone wants to protect their property, if they think they're, you know, under threat, right, they can just shoot.
Yeah, George Zimmerman.
You know, stupid stuff like. Yeah, yeah. So if a company like Time Warner Cable, UPS, and Federal Express can belong to ALEC and gouge you for shipping a package across town, and while at the same time trying to destroy the United States Postal Service, which is one of the largest American unions, something is wrong with that logic.
Yeah, maybe, you know, what we should be proposing and pushing, Kurt, and we need a think tank to figure out how to formulate this, but – you know, corporations pay dues. They pay, you know, $100,000 or more a year to be members of ALEC. And they pay dues to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And arguably, these are lobbies for corporations. So maybe we should be saying, hey, corporations shouldn't be forced to pay dues to these lobbies. That's tyranny, or something like that. I don't know how to quite formulate the legal argument or even the moral argument for that. But they, you know, they, corporations have their unions. And they have their lobbyists. Why can't workers?
Exactly. Now, here's the last point I want to make, okay? The Koch brothers, along with the Republican Party, this unholy alliance that has come about because of the Citizens United versus the FEC decision,
right,
they've got it hooked up in such a way that almost nothing – you can't get through your entire day. There's nothing you can't do that doesn't support the Koch brothers in some form or fashion. I'm looking at their Koch Industries Wikipedia site right now, and these guys are not just into oil. They are into 12 different industries.
Sure.
Here's a short list: asphalt, chemicals, commodities trading, energy, fibers, fertilizers, finance, minerals, natural gas, plastics, petroleum, pulp and paper, and ranching. And just one of those things from the list: pulp and plastic. Koch Brothers makes all the plastic bottles that are in the containers when you go to Walmart.
Wow. Kurt, we're running out of time. But thank you. Your point was eloquently made. I appreciate it. Great to hear
from you. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Two new books by Tom Hartman out in paperback, The Crash of 2016, just out in paperback, and my newest book, Death in the Pines. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. Stoned drivers are a lot safer than drunk ones, new federal data show. It's over at DU, but it's from the Washington Post, WashingtonPost.com. When it comes to driving, alcohol is much more dangerous than other drugs. The change in odds that you'll be in an accident compared to driving sober. Thank you. It is, you are 600% more likely to get in a car accident driving drunk than driving sober. If you're using sedatives, you're about 10% more likely. If you're using painkillers, you're about 8% more likely. If you're using stimulants or antidepressants, you're actually less likely to get in a car accident than if you're driving sober. And with pot, with marijuana, there is no difference between pot and driving sober. That's fascinating. This is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that did this study. Stoned drivers are safer than drunk drivers? Gee, who would have thought? I would have. I mean, you know, it just makes a certain amount of sense. Anyhow, Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, didn't you call yesterday? Charles? You're on the air? Apparently he's not. Kevin in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Look, I wanted to disagree with you. I don't think government is not big enough. I think government is far too large on the centralized level of our federal government.
What's your evidence of that, Kevin?
Well, my evidence of that is the TPP. You have, and I mean, I could go on all day. anything from the Trans-Pacific Partnership all the way to our local post office, it's all favors whoever has the strongest lobby. And
yeah, Kevin, you're making my point. Our government is not strong enough to stand up to these transnational corporations.
No, Tom. But my point is that we need communitarianism to save this country. It's not government that's going to save us, not central government. Washington, D.C. is the land of Oz. They don't care about what happens to people. The state government is the...
Yeah, these are nice bumper stickers, Kevin, but your evidence demonstrates that our government is not big enough or strong enough to stand up to private billionaire interests or to private for-profit corporations. And that says to me that we need a larger, stronger government.
Even Karl Marx said once you nationalize, the government would disappear because the government was...
What is nationalized in the United States, Kevin? This should be privatized.
What I'm saying is that the idea of growing government to provide protection is not the answer. We need...
Of course it's the answer. That's why George Washington had three horses shot out from underneath him. He was trying to fight back against an oppressive corporation, the British East India Company.
Tom, those corporations have always been married to government. And my point is that unless you have community policing and community-centered laws that can actually work for the people, you'll never be able to hold the federal government accountable.
You know, I don't disagree with you, Kevin, that community-based politics and community-based activity, you know, Thomas Jefferson's idea of the most important and powerful, you know, government sector in the United States is the local ward. I agree with that. Here's the problem. You've got the American Legislative Exchange Council providing model legislation to states which say it is a crime in this state for a town to decide that it's going to offer community broadband. Pretty soon they're going to be saying it's a crime for a town to own its own electric utility. They are trying to privatize everything. This is
my point, Tom. If you had a free market, we'd be able.
Kevin, there's no such thing as a free market. This is libertarian fantasy.
Because Time Warner Cable gets its monopoly, it gets its SEC license from the government. If you would, I own a small business. If I could get by without having to abide by the same laws the corporations have and not having to compete against corporate welfare from those corporations, from the government to those corporations, then I would be able to have a much more successful business.
I agree with you, Kevin. Same here.
Competing me.
Same here. If I could take my paycheck in the form of stock dividends, the way that, you know, the CEOs of big corporations do, yeah, I'd have more money in the bank. I mean, I agree with you. We are being screwed by big corporations, and government is establishing rules and regulations that allow us to be screwed by big corporations. But it's not because government's too big. It's because government's too small to stand up to those corporations. And the same thing is going to happen at the local level. You've got states now and federal governments under the control of, captive to, the interests of billionaires like the Koch brothers and big transnational corporations who are passing laws making it illegal for local communities to stand up. You really want to see a great example of this? Go to the CELDEF website, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, Tom Lindsay's organization. He helps local towns sue to have the right to basically determine their own fate and future, to say, no, we don't want a 10,000 hog farm in this town, or no, we don't want fracking in this town. And you've got these big corporations coming in and suing hugely these little towns, and in some cases, many cases, actually suing individually the mayor and the city council members, bankrupting them, wiping out these little towns because government isn't strong enough to stand up to them.
But if you kept power concentrated at the community level and let the communities provide their own laws, just like a state has a Department of Environmental Quality, just like a state has a Department of Education, if you put everything at the lowest possible level, those people would have more authority than what they do with the federal.
How do you do that, Kevin?
Just like in Louisiana, where, you know, you have BP come in after Katrina and the federal government limits the caps on settlements. It's simple. You just downsize the departments that are out of control in the federal government.
Wait a minute. You're suggesting Louisiana is one of the most corrupt states in the United States. You've got judges are elected down there. You've got judges who are bought and paid for by the oil industry, who are making decisions on behalf of the oil industry and against local people on a regular basis. You've got an entire state legislature, the House and the Senate, that are bought and paid for by the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry. You've got a governor, Bobby Jindal, who is bought and paid for by those industries and the private for-profit prison and school industries. This is your model?
Tom, it's no different than a federal level. All I'm saying is it's more accountable at a localized.
Theoretically, you're right. And this was Jefferson's vision for America. And Madison thought it should be more centralized at the federal government. And we have Madison's country rather than Jefferson's country. But I don't see how that's the solution to where we're at right now. The last time we had giant corporations reaching out to control America, to basically destroy our economy for their own benefit, was in 1929. And because in 1921, Warren Harding deregulated the corporations. He deregulated the banks. He deregulated Wall Street. And he cut the top income tax rate from 94% down to 25% on the billionaires and the multimillionaires. The result of that was the great crash of 1929. And in 1930, and Shane, get that clip of FDR saying, "I welcome their hatred." In 1932, you had a man stand up, and he wasn't the best candidate. He was a wealthy guy from a wealthy family. He was an oligarch. Franklin Roosevelt, he was the corrupt governor of one of the most corrupt states in the Union, New York State. It was Wall Street on his watch. He was supposed to be responsible for looking over them, who brought down the country. I mean, he was a very imperfect messenger. But FDR got far more imperfect, frankly, in my mind, than Hillary Clinton. But FDR got the message that American people were being screwed, and they were being screwed by a very specific group of people, the rich and powerful. And he stood up and fought back, and that fight back lasted for 40 years. Here's what FDR had to say about these people.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
So, respectfully, I'm all in favor of devolving power. Devolving is the wrong word. Of amplifying power at the local level and diminishing power at the national level, at least with regard to many issues. But I don't see how to do it when the Supreme Court says that billionaires can own as many politicians as they want, the McCutcheon case, and they can spend as much money on them as they want, the Citizens United case. And it doesn't even have to be billionaires. It could be Saudi sheikhs. It can be Chinese oligarchs. It can be, Shelley Adelson taking money out of China, out of Macau. Chinese money supporting the Republican Party via Shelley Adelson. Or it could be, guys who made their fortune with Joe Stalin in the oil industry, Fred Koch, and, the fortune that he left to his sons, David and Charles. I mean, the Supreme Court has said it doesn't matter. Anybody can buy our democracy. And because they're buying it they started at the federal level. Now they're starting to buy it at the local level. You've got local politicians, you've got groups like Americans for Prosperity, and now they've got another spinoff. I forgot the name of it, but it's specifically, this is another one of the Koch brothers enterprises, specifically designed to buy politicians at the town level, at the county level. This is the destruction of the United States of America as a democratic republic. The conversion of the United States from a democratic republic into an oligarchy. Into a fascist, authoritarian capitalist oligarchy. It's happening right in front of us. It doesn't take any kind of magic glasses to see it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You don't have to do like Joseph Smith and get your, magic glasses to read the golden plate. You just look around. Hey, it's happening. Welcome back. Grace, watching Free Speech TV in Los Gatos, California. Hey, Grace, what's on your mind today?
Hey, it's so great to talk to you again. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for calling, Grace.
Good. Listen, I want to understand, or I don't understand, let me put it that way, why, with the Citizens United ruling, they ruled on a question that was not even asked.
That's correct. That's correct.
So I don't understand why it's being dumped in our lap to change the Constitution when they ruled on a question that wasn't even asked. I don't understand why there's not some sort of mechanism in place to either vacate their ruling or audit them for corruption, because I believe they've been corrupted.
Oh, yeah.
They had to have made a deal that has to be in writing somewhere. Can they be audited? And also, they are federal judges, so they must adhere to ethics rules. How they got around that, I just don't understand.
Well, let me explain it. First of all, the Supreme Court has ruled that they don't have to abide by the rules. They do not have to abide by the federal court of the federal code of judicial conduct. So,
isn't there a mechanism to vacate that ruling?
Yes, I'll get to that in a second. Scalia and Thomas, for example, go out to Koch Brothers events and get wined and dined and all kinds of goodies and things. If they were federal judges, they could go to jail for that, or at least be, you know, impeached for that. But as members of the Supreme Court, they say, we don't have to pay attention to those rules. They created a no demonstration zone around the Supreme Court. No other politician can do that. They just make up their own rules. No TV cameras in the courtroom, that kind of thing. Here is how they could be regulated. This is Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph 2 of the United States Constitution. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress can make. So Congress has the power to pass a law saying, sorry, Supreme Court, your deliberations must be transparent. Sorry, Supreme Court, you have to have cameras and microphones in the courtroom. Sorry, Supreme Court, you may not rule on the campaign finance laws that we just passed. Sorry, Supreme Court, you have to abide by the federal code of conduct, which applies to every other federal judge in this country. Congress can do that. Congress has the authority to do that. Congress has done things like that in the past. Congress is afraid, but it's not that they're afraid. Congress is now controlled by the Republicans. The majority of the Supreme Court is controlled by the Republicans. They're all in the same bed. They're all on the same side.
Right, but I think that there should be a mechanism outside of Congress. Where's the Department of Justice on that?
That would be a true constitutional crisis. That's the executive branch, and the executive branch has no authority over the judicial branch. The Congress, the legislative branch, has clear authority over the judicial branch. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 84, I think it was, said, you know, the courts are the least likely to offend because they have neither the power of the purse nor the power of the sword. Congress has the ability to appropriate and spend money. The executive branch, runs the military and the police. The Supreme Court does neither. But the Supreme Court has asserted the power to strike down laws, which is not given to them in the Constitution. They have asserted the power to create doctrines like corporations are people and money is speech, a power which is not given to them in the Constitution. And Congress has failed to do their job of holding the Supreme Court responsible for these things. And now that the Republicans control Congress, they're loving what the Supreme Court's doing. Grace, thank you for the call. Check out movetoamend.org for more information. Welcome back, Tom Harbin, here with you, Bruce, in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind today?
How you doing?
Great. You want to talk about Governor Bruce Rauner, the right-wing Republican multimillionaire who bought his way to the governorship of Illinois?
Yeah, I got to turn off. I'm connected. Hello?
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
I was thinking the other day, in fact, this has gone on for a long time, our local newspapers and the Chicago Tribune, they don't talk about anything that has to do with ALEC or business deception.
No, it's because they're owned by the oligarchs, too.
I realize that. So I've been doing a lot of research, and when Rauner yesterday said that people don't have a choice on collective bargaining versus lobbying, if there's a fine line there.
Right.
I got to thinking what people need to do, we need to have it local, and we have to have it consistent over a long period of time, is to ticket all of these big boxes and Walmart, Target, Home Depot that are in ALEC and everything, and ask them to establish two tiers of pricing. One tier would be for those that don't want their to support financially the lobbyists of these big companies. And the other would be for anybody else that says, oh, okay, their lobbying is fine, they can pay the higher price. But right now, I'm in a situation where I don't have a choice when I go into a store, you know, and I want to buy Bounty paper towels. I think that's owned by the Koch brothers, as is Northern Tissue and all that. If I want to remodel my house, I have to buy Georgia-Pacific, which is owned by the Koch brothers.
Right.
And every time I go in that store, I'm contributing to their lobbying, and I don't want to do it.
Right. That's a good point.
I'm thinking is if, you know, organized groups, it doesn't have to be unions, it could be any group that does not believe with their policies, get out and carry a picket in front of Walmart and say, I don't want to support your lobbying, lower my prices.
Right. Here's my solution for this, Bruce, and I lay this out in my book on equal protection and also in Rebooting the American Dream. But it's pretty straightforward, and unfortunately, I can't get unions to understand how this works for their benefit. And so I've talked with several union leaders about this, and they disagree with me. But let me lay it out. The 14th Amendment says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. That has been used to assert that corporate persons, which includes nonprofit corporate persons, which includes unions, as well as the Koch brothers and Koch Industries, that they have certain rights under the law that give them the power to, the authority, the ability to buy politicians and to lobby for legislation. I have said, why don't we just say only natural persons can do that? You know, this was the original intent of the 14th Amendment. It was designed to free the slaves, not the corporations. And say, fine, unions can't lobby, Koch Industries can't lobby. Nobody can lobby. Let's ban lobbying. Let's call it bribery. The unions then say to me, but wait a minute, you want to stop us from lobbying? We're all in favor of you stopping the Koch brothers from lobbying, but don't stop us from lobbying. And I say to the union leaders, hey, you are a democracy. Koch Industries is not a democracy. Koch Industries is an empire owned by the Koch brothers, by and large, whereas a union is owned by its members and it's a democratic institution. So even if you're both forbidden from lobbying, the next step up from lobbying is citizen action. And so, you know, if the Koch brothers sent out a letter to their 100,000 employees or however many they have saying, hey, would you please send a letter to John Boehner telling him to push through that TPP thing? And if the union held an election and decided by majority vote over 50% that they wanted to take a position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then the union leadership said, you know, we can't lobby for this, but you as individuals, you 100,000 members of this union, you as individuals, you can call your members of Congress, you can show up at their offices, you can hold signs and march down the street, we can't lobby, but you can. I would suggest to you that the employees of Koch Industries don't give a rat's ass what the Koch brothers want, by and large. And so they're not going to do what the Koch brothers tell them to do. Whereas the employees or the members of the union, they voted on this thing. They decided this. At least half of them are going to show up and participate. So the unions are way ahead in my calculus. And yet you could say that this is a completely fair situation. We're going to take away the ability of all corporations, for-profit, not-for-profit, churches, unions, whatever it may be, to try to influence government. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, I agree with that. But unfortunately, right now we are in the situation where the dialogue on this is turning into a losing battle.
Sure.
You need to have it out there on a more regular basis.
Yep. That's why I'm having this conversation today.
Yeah, and this is, and you're one entity, but if you get out in the local communities, you pick a Walmart and say, I don't support your politics, lower my prices, I don't want to pay your lobby.
Right.
You're going to have so many more people at the local level that...
But Bruce, you're going to be talking to a clerk in a Walmart who has no power, no authority, doesn't and generally even have the ability to kick the information up the food chain. And if they do, it won't go beyond, you know, one or two people up the food chain. The Walton family's never going to hear this.
But if you're out there and all of a sudden your local newspaper or the patch and they start writing stories about this, and you start getting multiple businesses where you have people out in mass
right.
that agree with this, because I feel helpless right now with our state government and our national government.
Well, and it's not just Coke Industries. It's big oil. It's big telco. It's big ag. I mean, all of these companies are lobbying. And I understand your feeling of helplessness. Bruce, I strongly recommend that you show up. You're in Homewood, Illinois. Show up at your local Democratic Party meeting and say, I want to become part of the solution rather than complain about the problem. Respectfully, I say that to you. Bruce, thank you for your call. You've identified a really, really serious issue, and it's one that we all need to be paying attention to. Thanks so much for being with us these 3 hours today. We will be back tomorrow to continue this conversation and pick up on, you know, whatever else is going on in the world. And don't forget, democracy requires all of us. It actually is not a spectator sport. You got to show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.